Hello, this is Reeler editor ST Van Airesdale, and welcome to the latest edition of the Reeler podcast. If you had told me at the beginning of the year that director Steven Sheinberg's latest film, Fur, An Imaginary Portrait of Deanne Arbus, would be one of the most controversial releases of 2006, I would have had your dosage decreased. Okay, maybe we could have argued about Sheinberg having cast Nicole Kidman as the legendary New York photographer of Freaks, Outcasts, and Nobodies. Maybe. But I had little idea that Fur would impel such feverish distaste, defense, and debate for simply trying a different approach to the tired old biopic. As per its subtitle, the film daydreams about 3 months in 1958, a period of Arbus's life during which she stepped out of her fashion photographer husband's shadow, distanced herself from her two daughters and her high society parents, and retreated to the apartment upstairs, where a mysterious new neighbor, played by Robert Downey Jr., with a bit of a body hair problem, entices her to a fantasy world that would soon transform her creative life. Beyond Kidman's performance and the elegant cinematography provided by Bill Pope, I appreciated Fur for the same reason many of its critics seem to detest it. It doesn't pretend to be an authentic chronology or detailing of Arbus's troubled days, which ended in suicide in 1971. It doesn't even want to be, and Sheinberg won't apologize for crafting fictional interludes from the raw materials that he and screenwriter Aaron Cressida Wilson, who previously worked with the director on the S&M fantasy Secretary, had to work with. Specifically, they borrowed fragments of Patricia Bosworth's 1984 Arbus biography, an acclaimed work that, for a while anyhow, looked like it would never be adapted. Sheinberg spoke with The Reeler earlier this week about the quote-unquote Arbus curse, and how he finally broke through and got the photographer on screen.
It's amazing to me how hard it is to sometimes get these things off the ground. And, you know, sometimes it's cast, sometimes it's money, sometimes it's the script, sometimes it's the director. It can be a guy who really wants to make the movie, but he takes another job. And then you wait and you lose the actor that you had who wanted to work with that guy. And the financier, in the meantime, makes two movies that tank, and you lose him. And or you develop a script, and it's too expensive to make. On and on and on and on. So, you know, I don't necessarily think it was the inherent subject matter, Arbus's life. But certainly one of the issues was what to do with that life. I mean, when you read the Bosworth biography, there are many movies in there. And, you know, you could address all kinds of things and focus on all kinds of things. But a lot of the films that failed to get made were the, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, biopic, birth to death type of things. And, you know, that just would never be of interest to me. I don't really like those movies. I don't think that they're complicated and deep and mysterious. I think that they tend to be obvious and basically programmatic, you know, for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, when I went and first talked to Ed Pressman and Bonnie Timmerman, who controlled the rights to the Bosworth biography, you know, I said, look, you know, I'm interested in doing this, but I have to do it in a different way. And, you know, to some extent, I got them when they were down. You know, they'd already tried several times, and they were deep into, you know, year after year of option payments and so forth. So they were, in a way, ready to try something different. And, you know, to me, Arbus's work merits this kind of treatment. It merits a mysterious fairy tale response and a kind of personal response from, you know, one artist to another. You know, her work was so ineffable, so undefinable, and so powerful that to just kind of, you know, deal with her childhood in a straight-ahead way and to deal with her suicide in a straight-ahead way, that's really not what her story is. I mean, obviously it's part of her story, but there are so many more complex things to think about when you look at her work and her life.
Okay, fair enough. So your writer has a run through the Arbus biography and comes up with a story that has only the faintest basis in reality. What is the director's responsibility to see that the character and everything that made her story worth telling in the first place come through in the end? In other words, if you're going to smash the biopic to bits, what's left to which you can stay true?
Biopics tend to be films where there's one big dramatic scene after another, because they're a kind of greatest hits album of the person's life. This big thing happened, we got to get that. Then this big thing happens, you got to get that. Then this big thing happens and you got to get that, right? It's a lot of screaming and crying and drug addiction and recovery from drug addiction and big performances and so on and so forth. This is what they are over and over and over again, right? It's kind of like VH1 movies, right? So this is a quiet, mysterious, poetic, trip into her unconscious experience. Everything that happens in the movie is unspoken. And, you know, it's all about currents, internal currents that can't exactly be defined. So, you know, you're dealing with a psychological and emotional and spiritual and artistic transformation that you might be able to watch, but only in the most subtle poetic interpretation. That's an entirely different kind of filmmaking. It doesn't, you watch the movie, it doesn't have anything to do with the way a quote-unquote normal biopic is done.
Kidman is transfixing as Arbus. Sure, her close-ups may be a tad too intoxicated with childlike wonder, but just as, for better or worse, Schoenberg has a fresh take on the biopic, so too does Kidman have a fresh take on obsession. Creative obsession, self-obsession, roiling behind her eyes, an electricity only her camera could harness. Schoenberg described working with the Oscar winner to develop their new kind of non-fiction heroine.
You know, part of it was, you know, when we first talked about it, she said to me, well, do you want me to listen to tapes of Deanne talking, and should I meet people she knew, and so on and so forth? And I said, absolutely not. You know, this isn't a performance where you're going to imitate a famous person. So forget about all that. The thing that has to be understood is, or has to be explored, is what was going on for her in 1958 with two kids and a husband, having done this, what she felt was banal fashion photography for years and years in their studio together. What was going on in her in those few months when she left that life and she began the journey of becoming the Deanne Arbus that we know? That is a profound, complicated, deep transition internally, and one which, you know, Nicole had to understand and feel. And that was the task of the movie, not to walk like Deanne Arbus or talk like her, but to grapple with the pain of that, the curiosity that drove it, the wish that drove it, the internal explosion that was taking place. And that's a very exciting thing to play. You know, and a very exciting thing to try to connect with. And in a way, I don't think that that's, exclusively the territory of Arbus's life. There's some way in which, everyone has some sort of locked box inside themselves. And in a way, this is a movie that is, you know, simply and complexly about how does that box get opened, and what are the consequences, and what are the ways in which one's vision changes when the box is opened? How do your relationships to the people who are closest to you change? What are you willing to sacrifice for that? What's the cost of it? And so on and so forth. It's a complicated thing that happened to Arbus. And so, you know, that's a very, when you start to think of it in those terms, it's a very exciting part to play, you know, and so she and I talked about that a lot, and we talked about how does it get manifested scene to scene to scene to scene as we make our way through the film. You know, it doesn't seem for a long time like big things are happening in the movie, but by the time you get to the end, you realize that she's made this enormous shift. Her whole life has changed, you know, but there hasn't been all that usual stuff that you might see. You know what I mean? She's never screaming and crying about it.
Alas, as I said, not everyone is getting behind fur. And when I say not getting behind, I mean something a little closer to wants to light the negative on fire. These reactions baffle me. Realer critic Michelle Orange put it most mildly when she wrote that fur doesn't pull off its imaginary portrait with any conviction, while Time Magazine's Richard Schickel last week dropped an A-bomb on the film, writing, "Shane Berg wishes only to lie about Arbus's life and exploit it." Ouch. So what does Shane Berg think of the reaction his film evokes?
I have not read his review simply because I don't read Richard Schickel, because I don't think he's a good critic. I find him to be simplistic and foolish, so I don't read him. Mm-hmm. But having said that, to address what you're saying, you know, you cannot make a daring, unusual, completely risky film and not expect about an amazing, outrageous subject matter and not expect people to be polarized. I mean, when I made Secretary, there were people who thought it was a dirty movie, and there were people who were very moved by it. And those are the only kinds of films I'm ever going to make anyway. So I don't, you know, am I troubled by it? Not in the least. I know the game I'm in. You know, I'm not capable of making, nor am I interested in making a film that is attempting to appeal to everyone. That would be ridiculous. I mean, I'm interested in making the most personal films I can. And, you know, my own internal life has, you know, enough complexity to it, and I'm in touch with it enough that I'm going to put people off, and I'm also going to attract people. And you know, to me, those are the most interesting kinds of films. I mean, you know, what's the point in making a movie that is trying to be all things to all people? You know, having said that, I think that one of the things that the subtitle of the movie and the two cards at the beginning of the film are asking the audience to do is open their mind. Open your mind to a new kind of approach to a real person. Somebody like Richard Schickel is incapable of that. You know, and if you are incapable of that, you don't even have access to what the movie has to offer. You've missed it entirely.
Aha. So, you make the call. Fur opens today, November 10th, in New York. Thanks to Steven Schoenberg for the fine company and conversation, and check back next week when the Realer podcast returns with a chat with Fast Food Nation director Richard Linklater. Meanwhile, thanks for listening and for visiting The Realer, your home for New York City cinema news, notes, and happenings from the art house to the red carpet.